In the early 1900s, while most Americans were still getting comfortable with the concept of telephones and automobiles, Jesse Livermore was revolutionizing how Wall Street operated. His story, disguised as Larry Livingston in Edwin Lefebvre's Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, has become required reading for generations of traders and investors. Warren Buffett calls it his favorite book on investing, while hedge fund legends like Paul Tudor Jones and Stephen Cohen consider it essential reading. The book's enduring popularity speaks to its timeless insights. Despite being published in 1923, it remains in print nearly a century later, offering wisdom that transcends technological changes and market evolutions. What makes this book so compelling isn't just Livermore's remarkable journey from teenage bucket shop trader to Wall Street titan, but how it reveals the unchanging psychological truths that govern markets. As Livermore himself discovered, the greatest challenge in trading isn't understanding numbers, it's understanding yourself. My journey began humbly as a quotation board boy in a brokerage office after grammar school. With a natural talent for mental arithmetic, I posted stock prices on the big board as they came through the ticker. Those weren't dollar amounts to me, just constantly changing numbers that fascinated me during my 5-hour shifts. The quotation board stretched across an entire wall filled with hundreds of stock symbols and their corresponding prices. Hour after hour, I'd climb up and down the ladder, erasing and rewriting numbers as fresh quotes arrived, developing an intimate familiarity with price movements that few others possessed. I became obsessed with understanding why these numbers changed, developing an excellent memory for price patterns and movements. Each stock seemed to have its own personality. Some moved erratically, others followed predictable patterns. I noticed how certain stocks would lead market movements while others lagged behind. Railroad stocks, particularly active in those days, displayed distinct behavioral patterns during different market conditions. Soon, I started noticing how stocks behave during advances and declines, meticulously recording observations in a small notebook. I documented everything, volume patterns, price reactions to news, and how different sectors moved in relation to each other. I wasn't imagining trades, but making actual predictions I could verify later. This was my introduction to reading the tape, understanding market psychology through price action. The ticker tape became my teacher, revealing subtle hints about market sentiment through the spacing and frequency of trades. By 14, I got my first trading opportunity when an older office boy proposed pooling money on a Burlington tip. I checked my notes and saw Burlington was indeed acting as it usually did before rising, showing increased trading volume and holding steady during market dips. We made the trade through a bucket shop, and I earned $3.12, my first profit. This small success confirmed what I had learned from studying the board. Price patterns could predict future movements. My success in bucket shops, gambling establishments that took the opposite side of customers' stock bets without actually executing trades, quickly outpaced my office salary. These establishments operated in storefronts across the city, offering small traders a chance to speculate without owning actual shares. By 15, I had earned my first $1,000, shocking my mother, who couldn't believe such earnings were possible for a boy my age. As my winnings grew, smaller bucket shops banned me, calling me the Boy Plunger, a nickname that would follow me throughout my career. Eventually, only the Cosmopolitan Stock Brokerage Company would take my trades, imposing harsh conditions, 3-point margins, and premium pricing. They charged me higher commissions and required larger deposits, hoping these obstacles would drive me away. Despite these handicaps, I continued winning, using my deep understanding of price patterns to overcome their advantages. This early experience taught me something crucial. Nothing in Wall Street is new. The same patterns of fear, greed, and manipulation that I observed in bucket shops played out in the legitimate markets. Speculation is ancient, and patterns repeat themselves because human nature never changes. The market taught me its lessons without sparing the rod, but these early bucket shop experiences developed valuable tape reading skills and memory training that would serve me throughout my career. I learned to trust my observations over tips and rumors, a principle that would become fundamental to my trading philosophy. A man must believe in himself and his judgment to succeed in trading. I don't believe in tips. If I buy on someone's tip, I become dependent on them for when to sell. No one can give me advice that outperforms my own judgment, though it took me 5 years to learn how to make big money when I was right. The average ticker hound goes wrong from over-specialization, creating an expensive inelasticity in their trading. Successful speculation requires more than mathematics or rigid rules. It demands understanding a stock's behavior and knowing when not to trade if something doesn't feel right. What matters most is the ability to accurately appraise market conditions. Despite being right about market direction, I discovered I wasn't making as much money as my rightness entitled me to. My conservatism, taking small profits and waiting for reactions that never came, was costing me potential gains. Where I should have made $20,000, I made only $2,000. I encountered an older trader named Partridge, nicknamed Turkey, who always responded to questions about trading decisions with, "You know, it's a bull market." When a fellow trader urged him to sell Climax Motors for a profit and buy back cheaper, Turkey refused, saying he'd lose his position. This wisdom finally clicked. The big money wasn't in individual fluctuations, but in the main movements. As Turkey knew, sitting tight during the right trend is what makes real money. It's not difficult to be right about market direction, but it's extremely rare to find someone who can both be right and sit tight. The speculator's chief enemies are boring from within, hope and fear. When the market goes against you, hope makes you lose more than you should. When it goes your way, fear makes you exit too soon. The successful trader must reverse these natural impulses. In spring 1906, I went to Atlantic City for a vacation, completely out of stocks. While there, I experienced one of those curious market hunches I've learned to respect. Looking at the quotation board at Harding Brothers' branch office, I suddenly felt I should sell Union Pacific, despite having no logical reason. The market was strong and bullish, but I couldn't shake the feeling. I sold 1,000 shares immediately, then 2,000 more, confounding my bullish friend who demanded to know my reasons. I simply couldn't explain it beyond an overwhelming urge to sell. I abandoned my vacation and returned to New York that night. The next day brought news of the San Francisco earthquake. Despite this catastrophe, the market opened only slightly down and recovered quickly, the street failing to appreciate the disaster's magnitude. I increased my short position to 5,000 shares, then doubled it to 10,000 as fuller reports came in. When the market finally broke, I cleaned up $250,000, my biggest winnings to date. Later that summer in Saratoga Springs, I noticed Union Pacific acting like it was being accumulated. I started buying around 160, feeling comfortable as it strengthened with each purchase. Suddenly, Ed Harding called from New York, urgently warning me that insiders were feeding out stock to suckers like me. Despite my tape reading indicating buying pressure, I trusted Harding's inside information and sold all my shares. Then, believing it equally logical, I went short 4,000 shares around 162. The next day, Union Pacific directors declared an unprecedented 10% dividend. Wall Street was initially skeptical, but the market exploded upward. I immediately recognized my mistake in ignoring my own convictions for someone else's suspicions. I covered my shorts at 172, 174, costing me $40,000, a cheap lesson. Following the tape's continued bullish signals, I went long 4,000 shares, making back my loss plus $15,000 more. This Saratoga experience completed my education as a trader, giving me confidence in myself and marking my transition from haphazard trading to thinking about basic market conditions rather than individual stocks. My approach to trading is systematic. Buy on a rising scale, not a declining one. If I buy 2,000 shares at 110 and it rises to 111, I'm temporarily right and buy 2,000 more. If it continues to 114, I might buy another 2,000, establishing a 6,000 share position at an average of 111.34. Then I wait for a reaction to test market strength. If it drops to 112.12 and rallies back to 113.34, I'll buy 4,000 more. How those shares get filled tells me whether I'm right. If I get them too easily, something's wrong. I never want to buy stocks too cheap or too easily. I illustrate this principle with a story about Deacon S.V. White, a legendary operator. When given a tip that H.O. Havemeyer was buying sugar stock, instead of buying immediately, the Deacon sold 10,000 shares, then another 10,000. When both lots were absorbed by a rising market, he knew someone was indeed accumulating, so he covered his shorts and went long 30,000 shares. This tested the market's buying power before committing. This approach applies to selling, too. You can't unload large positions at will. You must watch and test to find when the market can absorb your sales. The timing of your initial transaction is crucial, and you should never make a second trade unless the first shows a profit. It took me years and hundreds of thousands of dollars to learn this lesson. In cotton trading, I followed this system religiously. With a target position of 40 to 50,000 bales, I'd start with 10,000. If it rose 10 points, I'd add another 10,000. At 20 points profit, I'd complete my line with 20,000 more. But if my initial purchase showed a loss, I'd exit immediately. This approach ensured I always participated in real market movements, even if I spent $50,000, $60,000 testing the waters. Once the real movement started, I'd quickly recover those exploratory losses. The Union Pacific incident in Saratoga in 1906 made me more independent than ever of tips and talk. Events proved I could read the tape more accurately than most people around me. I was better equipped than the average customer at Harding Brothers because I was free from speculative prejudices. I don't favor either the bull or bear side. My only prejudice is against being wrong. I recalled old Partridge's favorite remark, "Well, this is a bull market, you know," as though that were tip enough for anybody wise enough. It was curious how people who suffered tremendous losses from a 15 or 20 point break would welcome a 3-point rally, certain the bottom had been reached. When my friend asked if I'd covered my shorts, I explained that stocks must be good and dead before they rise. The rallies grew increasingly feeble as I pushed my luck. Every time I sold Great Northern Preferred, it broke several points. I felt out weak spots elsewhere and attacked them. All yielded except Reading, which stood firm like Gibraltar. Everyone warned me it was suicide to short Reading due to a strong bull pool with low-cost shares and friendly bank connections. Despite this, I sold a little Reading anyway, staying true to my principles. In the past, Reading's strength might have fooled me, but now I was anticipating a general break with no exceptions. I played a lone hand, but felt I had allies, underlying conditions. When Reading continued defying the downward trend, I gave two brokers simultaneous orders to sell 4,000 shares each. The supposedly cornered stock took a headlong dive from 111 to 92, where I covered my entire short line. After that, I had a wonderful time, and in February 1907, I cleaned up as Great Northern Preferred had dropped 60 or 70 points. I took profits because I figured the decline had discounted the immediate future. The crisis peaked on October 24, 1907, a day I'll never forget. Money was completely unavailable at any price. Brokers couldn't sell stocks because there were no buyers. The stock exchange president sought help from James Stillman of National City Bank, who took him to J.P. Morgan. Morgan ordered the banks to provide money using their reserves, ultimately saving the market with about $20 million. That day marked my winnings exceeding $1 million and the successful conclusion of my first deliberately planned trading campaign. When I realized how severe the panic was becoming, I stopped selling and began buying at bottom prices, knowing that continuing the bear raid would harm the country's recovery prospects. My wild dream had been realized. I had become king of the market for a day. The recognition of our mistakes should benefit us as much as studying our successes, but human nature avoids punishment. Stock market mistakes wound both your pocketbook and vanity. Sometimes traders make mistakes knowingly and afterward may understand how and when they made them, but rarely why. A wise and lucky man won't repeat the same mistake, but will likely make one of its 10,000 relatives. My first million-dollar mistake came right after becoming a millionaire following the 1907 crash. Having money merely meant more reserves. It doesn't make being wrong any more comfortable. Losses never bother me overnight, but being wrong and not taking the loss damages both finances and spirit. After my cotton triumph, I received a visit from Percy Thomas, the famous cotton speculator known worldwide. I had long admired him as a true speculator with the vision of a dreamer and a fighter's courage, a thinker who understood both theory and practice of cotton trading. Despite initially declining Thomas's partnership proposal, I began seeing him regularly, drawn to his magnetic personality, impressive knowledge, and remarkable plausibility. Though I wasn't bullish on cotton while he was, his constant barrage of facts and figures gradually undermined my confidence in my own research. I didn't completely accept his view, but lost my poise and ceased doing my own thinking, a dangerous state for a trader. I began to accept Thomas's facts and figures, gradually fearing my bearish position was based on misinformation. Once I covered my short position, I naturally went long, accumulating my usual line of 60,000 bales, an asinine play where I was merely following another man's game. The market didn't move as Thomas predicted, but instead of taking my loss, I made the catastrophic mistake of trying to hold up the market. My line increased to about 150,000 bales while I was also carrying a profitable wheat position. Feeling unwell and nervous about my overlarge commitments, I made the utterly foolish decision to sell my profitable wheat and keep my losing cotton. After selling wheat, it rose 20 cents per bushel. I could have made $8 million. Meanwhile, I kept buying more cotton to prevent price drops, eventually accumulating 440,000 bales before finally selling out. I lost nearly everything I had made from my other deals, leaving me with only hundreds of thousands instead of millions. This costly lesson taught me about my susceptibility to magnetic personalities expressed by brilliant minds. I approach manipulation as a professional service, similar to consulting a physician or engineer. When approached about handling a stock distribution, I first thoroughly research the security and market conditions to determine feasibility. If favorable, I set my terms, typically requesting graduated calls on blocks of stock, starting slightly below market price and incrementally. My first step is creating activity to advertise the bull movement. The ticker tape is the world's greatest publicity agent. I need no press releases or financial reviews. Activity naturally generates demand for explanations. Floor traders, who will trade any active stock regardless of price, become my first buyers. They follow the activity all the way up, spreading the word and distributing tips better than any paid promoters could. After attracting speculators' attention through activity, buying typically exceeds selling, especially since I've secured much of the available stock through calls. When public demand materializes, I sell on balance, often selling short against my calls when demand is strong. When momentum slows and the stock begins declining, I provide support by covering my shorts without depleting resources. This stabilizing process discourages both reckless short selling and frightened liquidation. I sell stock during advances, but never enough to halt the rise, encouraging conservative speculators while maintaining my ability to support the stock on weekdays. By remaining short, I can always provide support without personal risk. I'll illustrate my manipulation approach with Imperial Steel, where I marked up the price 30 points while accumulating only 7,000 shares and creating a market that could absorb almost any amount of stock. Imperial Steel was a respectable but dormant stock, about 30% publicly distributed, with no significant activity after listing. Despite occasional positive insider reports about earnings and prospects, it lacked speculative appeal. The stock remained in limbo, neither declining because nobody sold, nor advancing because nobody bought. My campaign began by determining how much stock would come to market on an advance. I quietly absorbed all stock for sale at 70 and higher, which wasn't much. Once I relieved this selling pressure, the path of least resistance was clearly upward. Floor traders, seeing this trend, began buying, and I supplied their demand with the stock I had purchased earlier. I carefully managed the process, not forcing stock on the market or seeking too rapid an advance. When buying slowed and prices stopped rising, disappointed bulls began selling. I bought this stock back at lower prices, which checked the decline. Then I repeated the process, buying on dips, selling on rallies, but always working higher. Speculation in stocks will never disappear, nor should it. Despite its dangers, people will always guess wrong, regardless of experience or ability. Well-laid plans fail because of the unexpected, from nature, weather, greed, vanity, fear, or hope. Beyond these natural challenges, speculators must contend with indefensible practices and abuses. The speculator faces four deadly enemies: ignorance, greed, fear, and hope. Human traits no laws can eliminate. Beyond these and unpredictable accidents lies another danger: deliberate misinformation disguised as helpful tips. The manipulation pattern is predictable. When a company's business improves, insiders remain silent while quietly accumulating cheap stock. As their buying drives prices up, reporters ask questions, but insiders deny having news or claim disinterest in market vagaries. Once insiders have acquired all the stock they want, bullish rumors suddenly emerge. Tickers report on good authority that the company has turned the corner. The previously silent directors now anonymously encourage stockholders. The public buys, pushing prices higher, and when dividends resume or increase, bullish news multiplies, with leading directors and prominent insiders describing phenomenal earnings and unprecedented sales. Insiders hold their low-priced shares while business remains good. But when conditions worsen, they silently sell. As the stock declines on this insider selling, the familiar explanations begin. Leading insiders blame bear raids while assuring the public that underlying conditions are unchanged and business has never been better. News tickers add that inside interests are buying the dips and bears have sold themselves into a trap. These statements prevent public selling when insiders don't wish to support the stock. But despite promises of a short squeeze, the stock keeps falling, weighed down by insider selling. I've never seen a genuine bear raid cause an extensive decline. What's called bear raiding is actually selling based on accurate knowledge of real conditions. Stock trading fundamentals are simple. Continuous buying makes stocks rise. When they turn downward with only small rallies, the trend has changed. No explanation is needed. Those who know the real reasons for decline typically keep quiet or falsely claim the stock is cheap. Many supposed insider statements are fabricated by parties with market interests. While insiders might tell big players when to buy, they never reveal when to sell. Corporate leaders may trade on inside knowledge, but typically remain silent rather than lie outright. Years of experience have convinced me no one can consistently beat the market. Wall Street professionals know that acting on inside tips breaks traders faster than any catastrophe. There's no easy path to success in Wall Street or anywhere else. After nearly 30 years of constant trading, I've concluded that no man living can beat the stock market. You may beat individual stocks or make money on specific grain deals, but you cannot beat the markets themselves. It's like horse racing. You might win a race, but you cannot beat horse racing.